Welcome to another episode of Lucid Cafe. I'm your host, Wendy Halley. If you listened to the last episode of Lucid Cafe, you learned that my life changed pretty dramatically a little over 20 years ago when I started having spontaneous waking dreams. I also mentioned in that episode that I had had a powerful nighttime dream where a man I didn't recognize put me into a deep altered state and then fed me a whole bunch of important information that I knew I needed to swallow. It wasn't until 6 months later that I discovered that today's guest, Hank Wesselman, was the man in my dream. And meeting Hank is what kicked my shamanic apprenticeship into high gear. If you're not familiar with Dr. Hank Wesselman, he's an anthropologist and evolutionary biologist who's conducted expeditionary fieldwork over the past 45 years with several international research teams in search of answers to the mystery of human origins in the fossil beds of Eastern Africa's Great Rift Valley. In addition to his scientific publications and his academic teaching in many universities and colleges, he is the award-winning author of 9 books on shamanism, including his critically acclaimed Spirit Walker trilogy, Awakening to the Spirit World, The Shamanic Path of Direct Revelation, a book he co-authored with Sandra Ingerman, The Bowl of Light, Ancestral Wisdom from a Hawaiian Shaman, and most recently, The Reenchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. A shamanic teacher for more than 20 years and an apprentice in this mystical tradition for more than 30, he offers experiential training workshops at the Brighton Bush Conference Center in Northern Oregon, Mosswood Hollow near Seattle, and the Omega Institute near New York City. He currently lives with his family on their organic farm on the Big Island in Hawaii. Also want to give you a heads up that here and there throughout the conversation, we had some audio issues. So at times it sounds like the speed of Hank's voice slows way down, like he's talking through molasses, but you can still make out what he's saying. It just sounds a bit strange. But then again, we're talking about strange stuff, so I guess it fits. Please enjoy my conversation with the chief, my old friend and teacher, Hank Wesselman. This is just going to be audio, so you can make faces or whatever you want to do.
It's not going to be video.
You can give me the finger, whatever you need to do. Yeah, it's just me and you chatting, having a conversation.
You just gave me the finger.
Oh, no, it was a demonstration.
You're funny.
Thank you, Hank, for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
We're off to a good start, huh? So yep. I've been hoping you'd come on, and I'm really thrilled to be able to have this conversation with you. I wanted to talk to you because, as you mentioned before we started recording, there is this growing interest in shamanism. And I think people are interested, but they're not quite sure why they're interested. There's a lot of discussion around how transformative it is, that shamanism can lead to transformation, but what does that even mean? And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, many people perceive and experience shamanic workshops as life-changing. And, you know, there are people who've done workshops in this, that, and the other for years, and suddenly they find themselves in a shamanism workshop. And it's about connecting with those inner sources of wisdom and power who serve or in service to us. And, you know, when you find your connection with the inner worlds, your life changes. You're aware of the fact that you've got power in your corner on the one hand, and you're aware of the fact that you've got friends on the other side who are rooting for you and who are willing to be in service to you if you ask them. And you have to ask them. You know, they have to be invited. That's the protocol. So the The shamanist movement is really a mystical tradition in which people learn how to connect with these inner worlds. And the first thing that they discover is that these inner worlds are inhabited. They're inhabited by spirits of various kinds, helping spirits, the spirits of the dead, the spirits of ancestors, the spirits of the higher organizing intelligences, some of whom were in service to humanity. And the whole game changes at this point. You know, it's like, you know, that wonderful film by Disney on Aladdin. And Aladdin finds himself conned into going into a treasure cave by some con man. He's just a schmuck from the marketplace. And before you know it, the cave closes up on him. And he thinks, I'm going to be here forever. And by accident, he encounters the genie, who's played by Robin Williams.
That's right.
And Robin Williams, you know, takes one look at this guy and realizes he has no idea what's going for him now. And so he sings him this little song. Of course, that's the way films go. And one of the things he says in the song is, you've got power in your corner now.
Oh, that's right.
And that's what it's all about. The name of the game for the shaman is power. And the more power you've got, the more you can do. Now, having said that, let me throw something in here. Sandra Engerman is a close friend, and I know that you've interviewed her. We wrote a book together, which did very well. It's still doing very well. And we're close. We've known each other for 30 years. And she got in touch with me last fall, and she said, you know, I'm being connected by some spirits who are ancient. I don't even know who they are. You know, these are ancient transpersonal forces. And I might just add that that's the way I tend to experience spirits, as transpersonal forces. And they usually have a personality and usually a strong one. And you know, working with them is an art form. And one of the things that Sandy and I discussed was the fact that she's aware and I'm aware that in the workshops that we offer, the hands-on workshops and the online workshops, that there are people who get it and there are people who don't. There are people who are just kind of shopping. They're kind of like window shopping. But the problem is when you connect people who are window shopping with these forces, sometimes they don't have the ability to work with these forces or to control these forces. And that is a kind of concern-making situation. And so this is just something I've become increasingly aware of, because I find that the people in my hands-on workshops at places like Omega and Braden Bush and Mosswood Hollow, and you know, I find that the population has changed. You know, back in the 90s and early 2000s, I got people who were members of the modern mystical movement who were already mystics, and they already had a very clear sense of who they were and who they were connecting with and what they were able to do with their mystical practice. And I find that in today's workshops, maybe half the people fall into that category, but there are about half the people who are just kind of like looky-loos. They're just kind of like shopping. And I don't know what they're doing with this knowledge and this technique and this process that I'm giving them.
Do they continue on? Do they just dip into it?
I don't know. I think they're just kind of like window shopping. They're just kind of going for this and going for that. And I feel a little uneasy about giving them access to these energies, which they may or may not be able to control and handle. You know, it's just something I thought I'd put in here because it's a current concern.
Right.
But you know, I look at, you know, the rest of the people in my workshops, and man, I watch their lives change. You know, it's extraordinary. As you know, Jill and I developed, my lady Jill.
Yes.
She and I developed these workshops over many years, and we no longer do our grad program. The continuum program is closed.
Oh, okay.
because Jill doesn't want to do the back-end work anymore. But I looked at those programs. We had 7-week-long programs. And I watched people transform. I watched this transformative movement. That's why I think of us as the transformational community.
I was one of them. I think I was in the first continuum program.
Were you?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we gave you a name.
Yes, you did.
We gave you a spiritual name. We did a ceremony for you.
Yeah, that was pretty life-altering. Yeah. What an honor.
And when we did the 4th week program, which is about the mystical nature of the self, you know, you were in the first one as well. And we managed to work it out. We worked the kinks out of that program, and it became very popular. And I now teach it as an online workshop with the shiftnetwork.com. And I'll probably be offering one later this year. That's going to be my proposal to them. Ha ha. Well, they like me. You know,
Of course they do. What's not to like, Hank?
Well, you know, I get a lot of praise from my workshop seminarians. They like the fact that I follow Holly Makua's directives. Mm-hmm. I tend to love all that I see with humility. That's not easy.
I know.
I tend to live all that I feel with reverence. That's easier. And I tend to try to know all that I possess with self-discipline. And so in bringing people into this work, I try to bring them into their own inner world. I don't try to lay a number on them. I don't try to, you know, have them pay attention to my wisdom. My job is to connect them with their inner wisdom because it's in there. You know, I mentioned in my book, The Bowl of Light, that this Hawaiian kahuna mystic I was in connection with for 8 years, Hale Makua, on the last night of his life, we were sitting in his car out in the rain. I don't know, maybe we were sharing a toke. I don't remember. we did do that. But, you know, I remember turning to him and saying, why has everyone forgotten the ancient teachings of the guardians? And he said something very interesting. He turned to me and he said, oh, they haven't forgotten. They just don't remember them. And of course, as was his style, he never explained. He never explained. I'm going to be working with some of his material today with the Shift Network, The Ancestral Grand Plan. Did you like that book, by the way?
I love that book. I've had to read it a few times because each time the material it deepens. And yeah. It's pretty heady stuff. I mean, there's a lot there. It's really dense material. But and I think if you try to understand it with your cognitive mind, with your Lono, it's harder to get through. But if you just read it and absorb it, I think there's a lot of wisdom that just kind of goes into your cells. It's good stuff. Yeah.
Well, you know, when that book came out, Jill read it and she said, you know, I'm just stunned that you were able to bring this all back because, you know, we weren't allowed to take notes.
I thought about that. Yeah.
Nicole was talking. I think I only had 14 pages of notes. 14 pages. Can you imagine?
And you created a book out of that.
And so Makua passed in a car accident in 2004, as many of your listeners may know. And then a year later in 2005, I was working on the computer the way I'm working right now, and Makua's photograph is on the wall right there. And he was looking at me and I was looking at him, and it was kind of like a credit card swipe went through my mind. Or maybe it was an insertion. And suddenly he was inside my mind. And he'd been dead for a year. And so it could be observed that we wrote that book together. And during the time I was writing The Bowl of Light, he would come into my dreaming on a regular basis. And if I didn't have something right, he would correct me. Hmm. He would correct me and he would bring me back to center. And so, although he always politely declined to write a book with me, on the last night of his life, he said, I know you're going to write about me. And he gave me permission. he gave me permission.
Wow.
And that book, The Bowl of Light, contains a lot of kahuna wisdom, none of which has been published before. And it's created quite a stir among the transformationals. You know, it's done very well in terms of sales. People all the way from, you know, Europe to China to Indonesia, they write to me on a regular basis and say, my God, this is absolutely terrific. We want another book. And I don't know if that will happen or not. But I am trying to write the fourth book of the Spirit Walker trilogy.
Oh, really? There's
that
more.
That might interest you. Yeah. Well, as you know, the Spirit Walker trilogy was about my ongoing series of connections with a man who lives in the future. These were visionary connections. And they went on, and they still go on for many, many years, for 20, 30 years. And I've had a look at the time at the end of Western civilization and what that time is going to be like. And so in 2003, that connection with this man closed down. It's like, you know, I'd published Spirit Walker, the first book, Medicine Maker, the second, and Vision Seeker, the third. And once the third book was published, it's like the opening just kind of closed. And I was kind of in mourning for about a year because I thought, well, it's over. Whatever it was, it's over. And then several years later, he clicked on again. And I was in a hotel near the freeway in Sacramento. Go figure. I thought when I moved back to the island of Hawaii that he would connect with me, but he didn't. It didn't switch on again. But as it has switched on again, I decided to engage in an experiment.
Yeah.
So many people have written to me of my readership, and they've asked me, we want to know more about Nainoa. We want to know more about his life in the future. You know, when's the next book coming out? So what I decided to do is when I connected with Nainoa in one of these visionary experiences, I made a proposal.
Okay.
I proposed that he write the fourth book.
Ooh, I got chills.
I would transcribe it. And he has been doing that. He's been writing in what he calls Old English. And so when I have access to this information, this knowledge, his written accounts, I transcribe them. And I clean up the syntax and the grammar and the spelling and so forth and so on. But he's essentially the one who's writing the fourth book.
Can you give us a hint about what the topic, what does he want to convey to those of us back here?
Well, the first part, I've got about 100 tight pages, more than 100 tight pages right now. The first thing he wants to convey is what his life is like, because his wife, Marea, is now the governor. Her grandmother passed, her mother passed, and the governorship came to her. So he's in that interesting position of being the consort to the governor. He's also well known in all of the land divisions around the Inland Sea because of his long walk into the interior. He created his own books. They're kind of like scrolls. They don't have bound volumes. They have scrolls, kind of like the Romans and the Greeks did,
Okay. Which
they seal in bamboo tubes, in racks, you know. Anyway, the first thing he conveyed was what his personal life is like. And this is quite interesting because I talk about his relationship with his wife. He now has a co-wife who's part of the dynamic, who is Morea's cousin, who is high chief is Nalu. And
he's a busy guy, huh?
He has children with both these women. And he's moved into a position of power and authority in this collection of communities around what they call the Inland Sea, which the Inland Sea is, those of you who've read these books know, is the Central Valley of California, which is filled with a marine inundation. And California itself doesn't look like California today. It's covered with tropical rainforest. And so, you know, his life is political on the one hand, economic on the other, very loving. His love relationships are something he's written about. Everybody likes that. They like it when I write about love relationships.
Oh, do they?
They do. And so I've, you know, transcribed a lot of this stuff. Hey, listen, it's pretty steamy. Mm. It's pretty steamy stuff.
Really, Hank?
I was working on this manuscript when I was at Brighton Bush Hot Springs in Oregon a couple of years ago. That's when it got kicked off. And it was about this time of year, actually in March. And people told me that there was steam rising off the roof as I was in there writing about his sex life.
So you're going to dive into erotic romance now? Is that the deal?
Oh, God. I don't know. But he's also writing about the fact that you know, I did some survey work for him back in the 90s about how to find his way into the Central Valley of Western Nevada, into the Great Basin, and how to capture a herd of horses and domesticate horses once again. And so what he's writing about right now is this ongoing preoccupation and creation of new land divisions at the northern end of the Central Valley, which is north of Mount Lassen. Mount Lassen is a volcano, and that huge escarpment that he writes about that he had to get up, there's no way you're going to get horses down that escarpment. But that escarpment ran north and south, obviously a tectonic event in geology. And I figured that if the escarpment ran up against Mount Lassen would be a plug, a volcanic plug, and maybe the fault wouldn't extend to the north. And I was right. And so in the far north of the Central Valley, a new land division has been created. And he's been the point man on this. He's a chief. So he's the point man on this. And he's written about, you know, what it was like to do survey into the interior of the continent again. And he's also written about his reconnection with Canojolak. Everybody wants to know about Canojolak, his Ennu wife.
Yes.
She's really quite something. And so that's what I've been writing about recently. So there's probably steam coming off my roof in Hawaii.
Right now.
Yeah. You know, I lead a very interesting life, Wendy. You know, there's the Hank Wesselman every day. That's me. And
yeah.
There's the Hank Wesselman who's the teacher. You know, I have this inner teacher who comes forward to teach when I teach, when I'm in hands-on workshops or online workshops. And then there's Hank Wesselman, the mystic, who is the dreamer. And my dreaming recently has been very vivid. I don't really know why, but it's like, you know, I have these very vivid dreams in which the imagery is so detailed, and it's like I can look at it and study it, and I'm aware that I'm dreaming. It's called lucid dreaming.
Exactly.
I'm aware that I'm dreaming, and especially just before dawn, there are these what are called hypnagogic hallucinations that come through, in which I find imagery projected into my inner eye, whatever that is, and I can study morphology, I can study details, I can study structure, and I'm aware of the fact that I'm dreaming, and I can sort of act in and direct the content of these dreams to some extent. This is something that's developed in response to my shamanic work. Because as you know, the shaman is really the master dreamer. And all of us dream. Although some of us don't remember our dreams because of a disconnect. But, you know, all of us dream. And dreaming is is one of our birthrights. It's one of our birthrights, and it's one of the ways in which spirit connects with us. And so I've been able to increasingly refine and develop this ability over the years that I've been teaching and the years that I've been participating in the dream time.
So you been able to understand what's coming through for you in the dreaming? Do you try to make sense of it, or do you just experience it and leave it at that?
Well, I experience it, and I try to make mental notes. And so what my lady Jill and I do every morning when we get up, we do something very intimate. We get up in the dark before the dawn, usually around 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and we light a candle and some incense, and we make a small pot of espresso. And then we sit across from each other every morning for like 45 minutes or an hour, and we talk. And we talk about anything that needs to be talked about her infernal condition, about our daughters, about our children, about our life. But we also talk about our dreams, and I share my dreams with her, and she shares her dreams with me. And we do it every morning.
That's beautiful. And
it's something I would really recommend to all of your listeners, you know, because our lives are very multi-leveled and we're very preoccupied all the time. We're very distracted by the nature of our lives as Western people. And so very often days, weeks, even months can go by without a really good, meaningful connection with your significant other. And I think this is very important for successful relationships. And of course, it's interesting for me because Jill is also a mystic, as you know.
Yes, I do.
And she has these very interesting deep visions, deep insights into the nature of reality and the nature of the self and the nature of the other worlds. And we share this information with each other. And so the workshops over the years have continually changed. They've continued to develop in interesting ways, unpredictable ways. And so when I get together with a group of people, like you do, I'm sure, as well, you know, I give them a little background. I give them a little foundation work from which to understand what they're going to go into experientially. And then I give them a set of coordinates. And I turn them loose and I direct them into the dream while they're very much awake. This is called shamanic journey work, as you know, and your listeners know as well. It's the ancient form of meditation. It's the ancient religion that predates all of our modern traditions, including yoga. So I'll give these folks, these non-tribal Western people, I'll give them some background on which to draw. And then I'll direct them into the dream world without telling them what they're going to see. We don't do this as a guided visualization.
Right.
And they will come back, as you know, about 20 minutes later with accounts that would pass muster at any Aboriginal campfire. You know, the Aboriginal people of Australia would find this absolutely riveting that we're doing this. And the Peruvians, when I went to Peru in 2003, I encountered a Quechua shaman. The Quechua people are the descendants of the Incas who live up on the altiplano of the high plains of Peru. They're up there around, God knows, around 14, 15,000 feet, growing potatoes in the cold. And the mountains go up for another 18,000 feet around them. And there was a Quechua shaman who connected with the travel group I was leading. And he looked at me and he looked me over, you know, this is interesting, you know, when a fellow mystic, especially an indigenous tribal person, looks you over and they discover that you're a human being like they are.
Yeah.
He said to me something very interesting. He said, you know, in my culture in Peru today, the young people don't want to stay up on the altiplano anymore. They don't want to stay up there for their whole life and run alpacas and llamas and grow potatoes. They want to go down to Lima and get a job and wear suits and ties and dresses and have a car and get a job at the bank. And, you know, they want to join the Western world. Well, the Western world is so pervasive, you know, with our perks, our material perks especially. He said, you know, the shamanic tradition in my culture is dying because the young people just don't want to go there anymore. It's like they regard it as old-fashioned hocus-pocus under the influence of Western Christianity. You know, I might just add here that Western Christianity has been an agent of cultural imperialism, which is absolutely extraordinary. Entire cultures and languages have disappeared off the face of the earth in response. But he said, you know, he brightened visibly, and he said, but the interesting thing is that the shamanic tradition has sort of leapfrogged and it's taken root in the Western world. And you Western people are going to be the carriers of this mystical tradition, this magical tradition, because it's about magic, about real magic. And he said, it's understood that each new generation has the responsibility to perpetuate and refresh a continuously recreated tradition, in the process even adding to and changing the accumulating hoard of wisdom and technique. Because it was always in this way that the tradition remained meaningful and vital to the people who carried it and practiced it. And he said that Western shamanism will change in response to who you people are. So you've got to be very circumspect. You've got to, you know, it's the old reverence, discipline, and humility program. He said, you've got to be very circumspect with what you're doing because, you know, it's not just about power. People can acquire power, but if they're not ethical people, they can use that power in non-ethical ways. So you have to understand what the nature of the sacred is. And you have to be aware that you're now participating in something which is ancient, which is ongoing, which is life-changing, which has the potential to change the world. Recently, you're on Facebook.
I am.
I'm on Facebook. I posted a picture of the head and shoulders of a white buffalo that was born recently. And I get a lot of responses to my posts. And so one of the things I became aware of is that most of the people who are responding have no idea what the significance of the reappearance of white buffalo actually means. So I'm thinking of writing a midwinter newsletter and talking about white buffalo woman. And, you know, since
it's a powerful story. Yeah.
We're talking about it right now. This is a story that comes from the old Black Elk. Most people know the book Black Elk Speaks, but there was a second book also written by an anthropologist with Black Elk called The Sacred Pipe. And in that book, he tells about White Buffalo Woman and how she appeared on the plains to a couple of warriors. And there was a white buffalo that came over the hill and it rolled the way buffaloes do. And when it got up, it was this beautiful woman in a white doeskin dress. And she came over to these two warriors. And one of the warriors had lust in his heart. The other warrior was an ethical spiritual person. And because the warrior who had lust in his heart was deeply in the negative polarity, he was done. He just sort of crumbled and turned into dust. But she instructed the other warrior to go back to the camp, back to the bend, and set up a sacred lodge because she was going to come and convey something to them. So he did. So they set up the sacred lodge. And sure enough, she came over the plains as a white buffalo. And then she rolled and she became this beautiful woman in a white doeskin dress. And she came into the lodge and she's the one who presented the people with the sacred pipe, with the white buffalo woman pipe. Chief Orville Looking Horse is the current holder of that pipe. And she told the people how to use it and how it was wakon, how it was sacred. And as she turned to leave the lodge, she stopped and she turned back and she turned to a man named Hollow Horn. And she said to him, remember, in me there are four ages. In every age I shall come back and look on you, and at the end I shall return. And then she leaves the lodge, rolls, and turns into the white buffalo, and she walks across the plain and disappears. Well, the Lakota people and the Plains Indian people in general believe in these four ages. And they believe that at the beginning of the first age, a buffalo was placed in the west. And the buffalo's job is to hold back the waters Go figure. These are people that live in the center of North America. They've never seen ocean, and the buffalo's job is to hold back the waters. They believe that at the end of every age, the buffalo loses one leg, and every year it loses one hair. And at the end of the fourth age, when all four legs are gone and the buffalo is bald, the waters will rush in. Everything will be destroyed, and it will be the end of the four ages. Now, this is just of more than passing interest when you consider the sea level rise, which is projected. You know, I've written about this in the Spirit Walker books. And if I've got this right, and I believe I do, the sea level has begun to rise, and everybody's now aware of it. The climate deniers, we're not hearing much from them anymore. But the fact is that Blackall cuts us off the hook at the end. He said, with the end of the fourth age, the primordial spirituality will be rediscovered, and it will be on this foundation that the next cycle of ages will begin. And the primordial spirituality is the shamanic tradition. And over the last 40 years, through the work of various teachers, charismatic teachers, and indigenous people as well, the resurgence of interest in the shamanic tradition has come about. And my workshops are sold out. People are coming. And, you know, the mystical tradition is reasserting itself. I personally feel that it's going to form the foundation for a new religion. And people don't like it when I use the word religion, but the fact is we don't have really a good word to replace it with. Do you have a word you'd replace religion with? I mean, we use spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, that's because I definitely have a reaction to the word religion.
Most people do.
Yeah, because of the dogma. I'm not a fan of dogma. And to me, religion and dogma go hand in hand. So I would say like a spiritual discipline, maybe.
Yeah. And people are interested in this. They're interested in the fact that as they get in touch with their inner sources of wisdom and power, they change. And those inner sources of wisdom and power are always there. We're actually here on planet Earth to live life and to learn life lessons. A lot of people who are able to vision and travel in the other worlds, they'd rather be there than here. But the fact is that we're supposed to be here. We're supposed to be doing what we're doing. But when you adopt this inner mystical tradition, I have the feeling that within the next several generations, that all of our organized religious traditions, and I'm thinking primarily about Judaism, Christianity and Islam. You know, the dark side of these religions has led some people to call them the dark religions.
Huh.
You know, who's the Blake, the mystic Blake, William Blake? He wrote about this, about the dark religions. He did it 200 years ago. And he said, the time will come when the dark religions will depart, and the new mystical tradition will replace them all, in which we do, have the ability to make peace break out and make it the dominant reality paradigm instead of these constant wars that we're involved in. I don't know how soon it will happen. Carl Jung wrote about this, the philosopher Jung.
Mm-hmm.
He was having a conversation with a friend of his named Max Zeller. I think this happened in 1949. It happened in his house in Kusnacht in Switzerland on the lake. And Max Zeller told him about this ongoing dream that he was having. And of course, you know, Jung was interested in dreams.
Absolutely.
And so Zeller told him that he had this dream on an ongoing basis where he would wake up and he'd be in a kind of spirit body. And everywhere he looked, he would see swarms of people of every race erecting pillars. As far as he could see to the horizon in all direction, there were swarms of people who were erecting pillars, like you'd see in a Greek temple, columns. And he would have this dream over and over again. And he asked Jung if he knew the meaning of the dream. And Jung said, yeah, I know.
Nice impression.
He didn't say anything more. So Zeller asked him if he would, you know, give some insights. Oh, well, how do you know? And he said, well, many people are having this dream now. And I myself have had this dream. And he said, the pillars that they're working on is the foundation for the new religion, which will replace all of our existing religious traditions. And so Zeller asked him, well, how long do you think it'll take? And Jung twinkled at him and said, 600 years. And of course, he was thinking about, you know, the fact that it really took Christianity about 600 years to take over the show from the time of its inception in the second century, third century. And, you know, the rest happened, as we all know from history. But, you know, I think myself, when you consider that we live in a society with a worldwide communication system and a high technology unlike anything that's ever been seen before, I think it could take place much quicker. I think it could take 100 years, or maybe even less. Because what's happening is that the fundamentalist traditions like evangelism and fundamentalist Christianity, the young people who are growing up in these families are living in a different world that their elders lived in. You know, they're not going to the same church for 75 years and believing the same dogma. They are living in a cyber world, and they're being exposed to knowledge unlike anything that's ever been seen before because of the internet. And I think that the internet in this sense has the potential to really facilitate the appearance of this new mystical tradition. And, you know, this is what you and I are doing. We're actually out there on the road, on the mystic road, connecting with people. You're doing it through your cyber cafe. And this is a good thing, don't you think?
I absolutely think so. I'm curious what you think about the new religion. You see it as possibly having a shamanic bent to it, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
It won't be like it was in ancient times. I imagine it's because I'm noticing that the practice of shamanism is evolving as it's kind of infiltrating the Western world. It seems to be changing. What do you think?
Well, these are people who understand, by hook or by crook, that there is more than one level of reality. There's the level of reality that we live in on a daily basis, and there's the reality that we encounter in the dream time. Number two, these are people who know that it's possible for people like you and me, who have trained to go into this other world in a disciplined, structured, goal-oriented way, and we can do various things because of our ability to do this. Number three, they're aware of the fact that this other world is populated by spirits, by transpersonal forces, the spirits of nature, the spirits of elementals, the spirits of the dead, ancestors, higher organizing intelligences. Number four, they understand that each one of us has both a physical body as well as an energy body. And the knowledge of our energetic matrix is one of the signatures of our consciousness age. Next, you know, they believe that everything is connected to everything else. And the connections occur through what we could think of as the real internet, the energetic matrix, which I've written about in my unusual books. Next, they all have a strongly ecological awareness. They're aware of the fact that we have to discover the limits to short-term gain, so that we can acquire the knowledge of long-term ecological sustainability upon which the future of our cultures and the future of our species depends. Number seven, they tend to be pretty ethical people. You know, they're deeply concerned with the issues of the elderly, the issues of children, the issues of the gay, lesbian community, the issues of minority groups. In other words, there's a deeply humanistic focus. And they understand that as people move into and rediscover their own version of spirituality, they change. And as they change, the people who are in relationship with them pick up on it, and they change. And the family changes. So this is an interesting ongoing phenomenon in which it begins with the personal. We begin with ourselves. We fix ourselves. We change ourselves. And then it progresses through the family, through the society, into the global. And it has the potential to create an entirely new world. You know, these are also people who have a very strong sense of hope that we will eventually create that new world in which peace will be the dominant reality paradigm. And I just sort of add in here at the end that they're very concerned with the limits of short-term gain, as well as the limits of our Western medical systems. Now, our Western medical systems are fantastic. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you without the Western medicine kicking in at various times in my life, including an event where I had pulmonary embolisms in 2011 that nearly wiped me out. But I got through it. I'm on the Waffen Clinic on blood thinners for the rest of my life because I have sticky blood. If you're in a car accident and you have a ruptured organ, like a spleen, you know, that's not the time to go to your acupuncturist. That's the time to go to Western medicine.
Yeah, they're good with trauma medicine.
It's the time to find yourself in a room with a world-class surgeon and a world-class anesthesiologist and medical team. But they're also aware that spirit medicine and energetic medicine are adjuncts to, rather than replacements for, Western medicine. So, and those of us who have a healing practice, you have a healing practice.
Yes.
We're aware of the fact that a good medicine person uses everything there at their disposal when dealing with something ill, something serious. You know, for example, my lady Jill is dealing with a blood plasma cell cancer right now called multiple myeloma. We're using everything at our disposal. We're using acupuncture. We're using Western medicine. We're using chemo. She had a stem cell transplant. She does therapy. You know, she does energetic medicine, shamanistic healing. I mean, we're using the whole spread. And I think this is the way that medicine people have always worked. Because among the traditional people that I lived with in Africa, you know, if you got the clop or you got gonorrhea, you know, the medicine people would say, oh, this is a white person's disease. You need to go to the hospital. They wouldn't get out the rattle and shake the rattle and try to make this spirochete-induced illness go away with spirit medicine. That's the time for Western medicine, for physical medicine. And physical medicine is very good at what it does, but sometimes you have to lean on it to get it to do what it's supposed to do. And all of us know that. It's an interesting set of thoughts about the shamanic tradition and how it's morphing. It's literally morphing and it's becoming something else. But it's a mystical tradition. And when you know that you have the ability to connect with these inner sources of wisdom and power, the name of the game changes. And life becomes a really enhanced, interesting adventure.
I agree. What do you say to people who are deeply embedded in materialism and maybe think that everything you're talking about is bullshit?
Well, you know, there are people who get it and there are people who don't. It's always a readiness issue. And one of the things that I'm aware of is that it's not my job to create disharmony among people. So I always assessed very carefully how ready the person is to hear what I have to say. In other words, I don't go around laying numbers on people. I just don't do that. But more and more people are becoming aware of this. I'm aware of the fact, for example, that Hollywood is very interested in anything mystical. You know,
really?
Mystical. Oh, yes, they are. You know, I worked for several years to see if I could get the Spirit Walker trilogy translated into a Netflix or an HBO series, because with three books, we got enough for three seasons.
Yeah.
And I worked with a young woman who was a screenplay writer, but she wasn't connected. And, you know, I've actually got a proposal from another person right now about writing a screenplay and trying to accentuate this. I'm going to have to wait for somebody like Steven Spielberg to call me up and say, Hank, I just read your book. I need somebody at that level within the entertainment industry to see the potential for these works. It might not happen while I'm still here on this side of the mirror. I mean, it took, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien was gone for what, 15, 20, 25, 30 years before Lord of the Rings was made by Peter Jackson.
Yeah.
It might take some time, but my hope is that the Spirit Walker trilogy will eventually be transformed into the visual medium, into a series on television. This would be the best way to do it, I think, because the silver screen, you know, there's only so much you can get onto the silver screen in an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Right.
Whereas if you got an hour once a week for 12 weeks, you can really get a lot on there. And I think that that story, the Spirit Walker story, has the potential to change the direction of Western history. That's a humble thing to say.
You did just say that. Okay.
Why not go for the big one?
It's good stuff. It is good stuff. Well, I think it's definitely would get people's attention. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see it be made into a series.
Your books as well. You're writing?
I've kind of taken a break from writing. I did turn my one book into a screenplay because that's in my dreaming. That's what I saw. I saw a movie marquee, the story about my connection with the young man in a coma over nine months.
Right.
Yeah, the Slaying the Mouse, I titled
Slaying
it.
Slaying the Mouse.
Yeah, I did turn that into a screenplay. But I remember you told me years and years ago when you first read that manuscript that you said the world wasn't ready for that story. And I don't know if they are yet. I don't know. It's a strange little story.
Well, what we need are entertainment agents. And I don't know how to connect with that. So I've kind of decided that I've got to get the entertainment world to connect with me. And things will just happen as they happen. But if you've got that screenplay on your computer, it's there.
Yeah, it's there. It's collecting dust on my hard drive. Yeah.
It's on the hard drive.
Yeah.
This is good news. Well, it's delightful to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Yes.
To see you again after all these years. It's been a while since we've crossed trails.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I think it was 2012 was the last time we met in person. Yeah. I hope we can see each other again at some point in the future. That would be great in the physical. It's nice doing this via video, but I would love to be able to sit down and have a drink with you, you know?
Hey, that sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
We'll open the good stuff.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Hank, for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. I thought this was a great conversation, as I knew it would be.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure always to make connection with you.
I have to confess that recording this episode was a pretty wonderful excuse to reconnect with Hank. I so love chatting with him. If you have an interest in exploring shamanism, I can't recommend Hank's books or workshops enough. He's a good teacher. He's an accessible teacher. You can find out more about his teaching schedule and his books at sharedwisdom.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.